I will now call the second case set for oral argument today. That case is number A241123, captioned In Re the Matter of the LaDuke Living Trust. Council, I assume are familiar with our general protocols. Each side will have 15 minutes for its principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have 15 minutes for rebuttal. Our lectern is adjustable. There are two buttons on the front edge of the surface that will allow you to put it up and down as you wish. Counsel for appellant is ready to go. Could you please state your name and the name of your client or clients, and then you may begin.
Jeff Markowitz for appellants Janae LaDuke and Bruce LaDuke. May it please the court. Donald and Mary LaDuke objectively manifested their assent to the forgiveness on death term in the 2017 contract by signing directly beneath that term. They then repeatedly reaffirmed that assent in 2018 through re-signing, and in signing the amended contract in 2019 with their codicils, in the presence of their attorney who was advising them and two witnesses, all three of whom found them of sound mind and under no undue influence at the time. The district court's determination that Donald and Mary never agreed to this term in the 2017 agreement should be reversed. It also should be reversed for a threshold reason, and any striking of that term, to the extent the term was struck, because no one ever asked for that relief in district court, not Margaret Nold, not Gary LaDuke, and furthermore, appellants Janaea and Bruce objected to the proceeding covering the validity of that agreement, none of which respondents dispute on appeal. Lastly, and the point I plan to spend the balance of my time on today, the striking of the forgiveness term from the amended contract, and again, to the extent it was struck from the 2017 contract, should be reversed, both for standing jurisdictional reasons and on the merits, because the incapacity and undue influence findings are clearly erroneous. I plan to go right to standing absent questions, except for to make one practical point. If the court agrees with us on this jurisdictional piece, it need not move to the undue influence incapacity issues, but there are some practical considerations that might warrant doing so as alternative reasons for reversal. One of them is the district court indicated apparently some misunderstandings of Minnesota law that we submit are clear based on established precedents and statutory text, and even a non-precedential opinion addressing them might provide clarity. And the other reason, though, is a very human one. This is a highly emotional case. It's been going on for 4 years, and reaching the merits in the alternative could provide some closure to all those involved. On the standing piece, this issue rises and falls on plain statutory text. Margaret Nold sought relief under only one statute, the set-aside statute. She did not become the conservator until 2023. The statute grants the conservator limited standing to seek a set-aside of contracts and other matters made within 2 years of the conservatorship's establishment. Of course, 2017 and 2019, the dates of the original amended contracts, are before 2021. And that's it. Margaret Nold never had standing to challenge those matters, so the district court never had jurisdiction to strike any terms from either of those two contracts. And that's the end of the analysis. The district court concluded it had equitable discretion, and that was wrong for a few reasons. Principally, equity follows the law, and we have a controlling statute. That's going to be particularly important in cases where the text is dealing with standing. This is a cart-horse problem. The district court can't tap into its equitable discretion unless it has subject matter jurisdiction. The district court does not have that jurisdiction unless someone is invoking it with standing. Equity cannot reach back in and change anything that is required by statute for standing.
Mr. Markowitz, petitioner filed the two petitions within the two-year time period, and the district court did not rule on the conservatorship petition until much later. I mean, isn't this the district court's fault, not petitioner's fault? the fact that she was not made conservator within the two-year period?
No, and there's an important other point. I think it takes time to appoint a conservator. Practicalities involving putting forward evidence, potentially going to a disputed bench trial, which was necessary here. I think the fact that the district court didn't just decide the conservatorship on the papers or in a hurried fashion, I don't think there's anything wrong with that piece. Part of the problem here, and this procedure is very unusual. Normally, we have conservator first, and then the conservator as an independent fiduciary looks back for 2 years and says, okay, is there anything that should be concerning here from a matter of, as a matter of undue influence or capacity that we should have the court take a look at? Set-aside petitions, a desire to disrupt contracts, is not supposed to drive conservator position, conservatorship position, petitions. And the one case in which this court has addressed anything like this was the Douglas decision from 2004-14, which we cite in our papers. It's non-precedential, but it essentially concluded exactly that, that a person, the legislature could never have intended to allow set-aside relief for non-conservators, especially when that person has an interest in the estate of the of the conservatee and would stand to financially gain, which is exactly what we have here.
When the district court denied the motion to dismiss, I'm looking now at page 9 of the addendum, paragraph 10, district court made reference to, made a couple of references to an agreement. Like, for example, paren 2, nobody is prejudiced by the way the parties have agreed to determine the issues. I'll let you find your place there on addendum 10, addendum 9, paragraph 10.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, was there some agreement that you know, these two petitions would be ruled on simultaneously?
No, Your Honor. Where are you looking?
Well, addendum 9, paragraph 10, third line says the parties agreed at the beginning of the hearing that the only matter for the hearing was the motion. The appointment hearing would come later. Court sees no impediment for four reasons. The third, the second reason refers to an agreement.
I've looked at that, Your Honor. That language is confusing. Objector's motion was the motion to dismiss. And so saying to the extent the parties agreed to a motion being heard, it's the motion to dismiss the set-aside petition. I'm not exactly sure what point two is referring to, but there was no agreement to have the proceeding go forward on the set-aside petition while the conservatorship proceeding was being decided. That was the whole point of the motion to dismiss, is that you need to have a conservator making the set-aside petition. That's a standing issue, and Douglas was cited by appellants in district court in their papers on that point.
What's your best authority that the two-year period, the look-back period, is jurisdictional and can't be modified by the court?
The text itself, and wrestling through what else would it be? It's saying that a person is allowed to come into court for relief when that person is not the injured party. I think it's a first principles point. I don't have a case to say that. I think we have standing in two ways. An individual is injured in fact, or generally there's a statutory grant. This appears to be a statutory grant of standing.
What's to stop, if you don't have a conservator already appointed, to try to run out the clock on the 2 years by filing motions to dismiss and having a bench trial for appointment of conservator to get that two-year period beyond the point where, well, now you can't even look back at the contract?
A few points. One, I don't think the legislature was envisioning a situation in which set-aside petitions drive conservator positions, conservatorship positions. I think it was thinking in the reverse. The independent fiduciary comes in as conservator, looks back 2 years and says there's something of concern. Court, take a look at this. And there are other remedies out there, and apparently ones that strategically respondents chose not to pursue. Margaret Nold was the attorney. In fact, she claims that there was some alternative, a way that she could have sought the same relief through another lawsuit. If that's true, she chose not to do so. Individuals who have been incapacitated for a certain period of time or have been unduly influenced may not be incapacitated for that entire time, come to and realize something went wrong, or you have an attorney, in fact, who potentially seeks relief through some other path to the extent it exists, even though Margaret Nold chose not to pursue it. This is not the only option, necessarily. It's just the option that was strategically chosen here. The district court's equitable rationale falls also because it relied on a tolling and fraudulent concealment rationale, which suffers from two dispositive problems. One, this isn't tolling. A tolling pauses a deadline to give you more time to sue out a claim. The two-year look-back is not a deadline. It's a limit on the scope of the conservator's standing to look back into another person's life and ask the court to change something or disrupt a contract that was entered or a gift or transaction. And fraudulent concealment requires a duty to disclose. There's never been any basis for a duty to disclose identified by the district court or by respondents for why adult children or grandchildren would have a duty to disclose to their other extended family members that there was a loan contract made between relatives. So those are two dispositive reasons why the equitable discretion here simply does not work, and it cannot do what the district court did with it.
Mr. Markowitz, there's an issue in the briefing about the 2017 agreement, the first agreement in sequence. Wasn't that agreement effectively superseded? Maybe that's the wrong word. But it doesn't matter in light of the 2019 agreement, which said that it was amending and restating the prior agreement.
2 points, forfeiture and merits. Forfeiture, this theory never came up in district court. District court never relied on it, and which segues into the second point, the complexity in particular warrants.
The district court did make a ruling that you're challenging about the 2017 agreement, right?
That the agreement, in the first place, it concluded it was never, there were no proper documents to execute it in the first place. It then revised that ruling in post-trial order to say that the there was an agreement, but not with the forgiveness term.
I should let you answer my original question. I'm sorry. Why don't you?
But proceed? On the merits, we walked through this in the reply. If the court wants to reach that issue, this touches into an issue that I don't think Minnesota law is resolved, but the restatement of second of contracts and out-of-state case law that deals with this pretty niche issue has resolved. And it's simply this: when you have two agreements and a later agreement purported to amend a prior one or replace it, but that later agreement is declared void, then it's as if that agreement never was and it restores the prior one. And that is the situation we have here. The district court purported to just slice and dice and just take out the forgiveness term. That's a material term. It's a material limit on the duty to repay the loan obligation. You rewrite the agreement in a fundamental way on an essential term if you take it out. So the voiding of the that one term voids the agreement, and that sends us back to the 2017 agreement, which has the same term, and that is enforceable. It was formed. There was mutual assent, and that would govern, and the forgiveness term would be the law. That would be prevailing.
Is that still the case when the second agreement has language about this is the entire agreement? The agreement constitutes the entire agreement between the parties?
Which takes us even to a more niche issue, which we walk through in our reply brief, in which I'll cite the page. Pages 16 to 17 of our agreement. But the severance of an essential contract term is not allowed even when the contract contains a severance clause. It's citing a Georgia case. We cite other out-of-state case law. But the point is that this always bottoms out an intent of the parties. Sometimes parties will put a pro forma severance or term like the one Your Honor was just describing, but it's not necessarily their intent. When you look and you see you have an essential term that to take it out makes a radically different agreement, then we say, well, the intent of the parties was never, we recognize that the essential term was, the agreement was never intended to be without the essential term, and we will say the entire piece is void even with such a term.
But which That I understand that argument, but my point is that the entire agreement for the in 2019 language means you don't look back to 2017 contract. The 2019 language says this is our entire agreement. So 2017 is just gone. So if the 2019 is void, then there's nothing else to look back on.
That's not the approach of case law. If you page 16 cites an example such as an insurance case from Florida, Spatz, if the trial court determines that the 1991 policy is void, the 1989 policy will be reinstated as if nothing had happened. So I think that's just how the approach would work, and it makes sense. It's a fairness matter.
Did you say that the district court's findings about capacity and undue influence were those relating only to the 2019?
The district court's order, when I read it, was a bit ambiguous as to whether it was 2017 or 2019 or both. We argued it as both. The view of respondents, I understand, is that it was just 2019 and they're only defending the incapacity. I see my time has expired, if I could conclude.
Yeah, please.
I were defending incapacity and undue influence on the 2019 side. We're happy with that, that determination. It favors appellants, and I think that is a fair reading, and it's consistent with the fact that all the way back to the set-aside petition, you only have the 2019 amended contract being challenged. There's bits and pieces about 2017 that come throughout, but that's really what this case was about. And yes, to your honor's question. So I think a fair reading of the district court's order is that it was only striking the forgiveness term based on undue influence and incapacitation from the 2019 amended agreement, and it was making a contract formation determination solely as to the 2017 contract and saying it initially didn't form at all and then later that it formed but without the forgiveness term. Unless there are any further questions, I'll come back at rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please state your name and name of your clients, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Sarah Sickenader. I represent the respondents, Margaret Nolde and Gary LaDuke. May it please the court. This is a case about the limits that exist to restrict the probate court's authority to exercise equitable jurisdiction. I have 2 points that I would like to make here today. The first is that the district court had equitable jurisdiction to hear a challenge to the 2019 loan agreement. And second, the trial record and the evidence presented at trial reasonably tends to support the district court's findings regarding contract formation, undue influence, and lack of capacity. I'd first like to talk about the jurisdictional issues. With that, I have 3 things I'd like to talk about. The first is standing. The second is the jurisdiction of the court to hear the case in the 2019 challenge to the, or I'm sorry, the challenge to the 2019 loan agreement, and then third, the jurisdiction of the court to provide the remedy in the trial court's order. First, looking to standing. Your Honor asked about paragraph 10 of the April 19th, 2021 order. What was the court referencing when the parties agreed to try the cases in order? The parties actually had a disagreement whether or not this should be bifurcated. It was the court ruled that the cases would move on together. But this goes to standing. Go ahead.
The disagreement of a bifurcation, wasn't that after the motion to dismiss was resolved?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, I mean, but when I was asking Mr. Markowitz about paragraph 10, I guess I'm wondering what agreement the district court was referencing that existed at that time.
Your Honor, I believe the district court was referencing the fact that my client, Ms. Nolde, filed a petition for guardianship conservatorship. There was an objection. It was moving towards trial. There was an agreement that this was a contested petition for guardianship conservatorship, and the parties were going to move forward with litigation in that case. I believe that's what, for that petition. I believe that's what the court is referencing. There's no challenge to Ms. Nolde's ability to bring the petition for guardianship conservatorship. She has standing. She's an interested party under the probate statutes. It was this petition that she filed that brought this case into probate court. In addition, she filed a petition for transaction set-aside, citing Minnesota Statute 524.5-411, subdivision E. With that petition for transaction set-aside, she asked the court to rule on a challenge to this 2019 loan agreement. I think this court doesn't need to get to the jurisdictional or standing requirements of subdivision E, because the district court can look at Ms. Nolde's standing as attorney in fact to bring a controversy before the probate court in conjunction with her petition to appoint a guardian and conservator.
But to bring a lawsuit as attorney in fact, that would need to be a lawsuit in the name of her father, Donald, right?
Indeed, Your Honor, but the district court in the April 19th, 2021 order denying a motion to dismiss acknowledged that she was bringing this on behalf of her father. The district court.
The petition doesn't say that. The petition says that she's filing as conservator or as putative conservator, but. A lot of your arguments in your responsive brief about what your client Margaret could do or were things she didn't do. It seems to me. I mean, she did one thing. She filed two petitions, but the one that we're concerned with, the transaction set aside petition, that petition relies exclusively on the statute you identified. But she didn't bring a separate lawsuit in his name.
That is correct, Your Honor. Although the district court in the non-dismissal order indicated that it would be sitting in equity to hear a challenge to the 2019 loan agreement with her pursuing it as attorney in fact. Essentially, Ms. Nolde brought a package to the court, which was this challenge to the 2019 loan agreement. The district court in the non-dismissal order pulled off the wrapping of this package and wrapped it into something anew. The parties moved forward then for three years with this case.
Can I go back to,
yes, Your Honor.
So you mentioned equity. What is the legal authority for the district court, the probate court to, it sounds like when you're making an argument of equity, it sounds like you are saying even if appellant is correct about the statute, there still is an independent basis for the district court's actions. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct, Your Honor. To answer the question where the court's equity authority comes from, I think you can look at the court's authority almost like a funnel. So the top of the funnel is the Minnesota Constitution. Article 6, Section 11 gives the probate courts the ability to hear cases in equity involving probate matters. Then as we narrow through the funnel, we look to Chapter 524, which is the probate chapter, that indicates as well that the court has the ability to hear cases in equity. And then at the narrowest part of the funnel, we're looking at the conservatorship statutes as well. If we look at Minnesota Statute 524.5-106, it indicates that the conservatorship court has jurisdiction over individuals and their property if they're living in the state of Minnesota.
Well, I'm looking at a statute just three before that one. 524.5-103, which says, I'm rearranging the words a little bit, the principles of law and equity supplement the provisions of this article unless displaced by the particular provisions of this article. And so, if there's a statute that is specifically on point, like 417E, doesn't that displace equitable principles with respect to that issue?
It does not, Your Honor. I think the inherent within subdivision E is an acknowledgement that there are equitable principles at play here, and that's the last sentence of subdivision E indicating that in no way does that subdivision limit the ability for the person subject to conservatorship to seek relief.
And again, that's Donald, not Margaret.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, Ms. Nolde was stepping into his shoes as attorney, in fact, which the court acknowledged in its dismissal order.
But her petition didn't make any reference to her power of attorney.
That is incorrect, Your Honor. As part of these proceedings, the parties were required, at least at the time, to file a bill of particulars. The statutory provisions for any petition before the conservatorship or the probate court requires disclosure of who is the attorney in fact. The attorney in fact was named in the bill of particulars, and a copy was provided to the court as part of this proceeding. So her standing in that way was disclosed to the court at the inception of this proceeding.
When I look at the petition, I see she is the petitioner, and at the very end it says pursuant to 524.5-417E. It seems like that was the exclusive basis on which the petition is based.
Your Honor, I cannot argue that that's how the petition was presented to the court. That is accurate. Ms. Nolde did seek relief under that statute. However, when we get to the motion to dismiss, this case gets turned a little bit. When the court looks at whether or not she has standing, whether or not there's jurisdiction, the court signals to all the parties that we are changing direction here. We instead are going to look at this as though she is the attorney in fact bringing this controversy before the court, and the court is going to use equitable principles to decide it. So in April of 2021, the court signaled to the parties that this was no longer necessarily falling under subdivision E. It was using its equitable jurisdiction to move forward.
And that's in the order from April of 21, is it?
Yes, Your Honor. You mentioned paragraph 10. It's a long paragraph. This is where the court cites four separate reasons for the moving forward in this case. I would point out to Your Honor that the court determines that it has the equitable authority to hear the case because it has been made aware of this controversy. It's aware of who the parties are, and the parties would not be prejudiced by the court hearing this case and it proceeding in this way because everybody is aware of what's at stake, what the relief is requested. So at that point, it was a clear signal to the parties that there was a shift in how the court was going to approach this case, which is consistent with the way that the district court ultimately ruled in this case in its trial order. Citing back to the April 19th, 2021 order and stating it would be sitting in equity in this case and providing using its equitable jurisdiction to craft a remedy.
Are you conceding that there's no standing under the statute 417E?
I am not, Your Honor. Our brief cites specifically that this subdivision E is a procedural tool. There is no jurisdictional requirement written into it. There's no standing written into it. Looking at the subdivision E in isolation, there is no indication that it's supposed to be used that way. To determine who has standing, whether or not there's jurisdiction, if there's a statute of limitation. It's merely a procedural tool under the conservatorship duties statute.
Even as a procedural tool, isn't its operation limited to gifts or contracts that occurred during the 2-year period before the establishment of the conservatorship?
Yes, Your Honor, that is what the statute says, but to the point of running out the clock, in this case, these petitions were brought in November of 2020, which was just about 6 weeks before the 2-year anniversary of this contract that had just recently been discovered by Donald LaDuke's attorney, in fact. And the district court indicated in its non-dismissal order that it would toll ruling on that petition until the conservatorship had been decided. So the court did acknowledge the fact that the statute exists, but ruled that Ms. Nolde had properly brought the petition within the 2 years.
And that's the decision that's under review, right? I mean, that's up to us to say whether that was correct or not.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe all three orders from the district court are under review here today.
Counsel, I'd like to ask about the, your opposing counsel raises a good point about only one clause was struck from the agreement. Why wouldn't the entire agreement be invalid versus just this one clause?
That's a good question, and that goes to the district court's remedy provided in this case. If we look to the contract itself, it does indicate that if one provision is determined to be invalid, it's to be severed from the agreement. That's paragraph 4B, I believe, of the amended loan agreement. So the district court properly followed the direction of the 2019 amendment in crafting that remedy. Additionally, once a conservatorship is established, the conservatorship court has jurisdiction over the person subject to the proceeding, their property, and their assets. Crafting a remedy like the one in the trial court order is within the court's jurisdiction over conservatorship cases.
But the reason for striking the one provision was based on being not competent. And so if you're not competent to enter into the one clause provision, how are you then competent to enter into an entire other agreement that becomes a mortgage?
Also a good question, Your Honor. In this case, in looking at the district court's trial order, the district court determined that the terms of the 2017 agreement could not be proved. There was no meeting of the minds. There was no assent. But the court did acknowledge that a contract had been formed. So whether or not Donald LaDuc had capacity to sign the 2019 agreement sort of evades the district court's reasoning here that the rest of the terms of the 2019 agreement aren't at issue, aren't a problem, because there had been a loan agreement that is acknowledged. It's just certain terms, there had been no meeting of the minds.
Your opposing counsel argues that the equitable tolling based on fraudulent concealment can only occur with, he argues that fraudulent concealment can be found only if there was a duty to disclose or a duty to reveal. So that concealment is a violation of a duty. I mean, where does that duty arise here?
Your Honor, my client, Ms. Nolde, was the attorney, in fact, for Donald LaDuc when this contract was discovered.
I thought she got the power of attorney later, after the contract.
Oh, this is a timeline issue, Your Honor, but she received the she was appointed as the attorney, in fact, after the 2019 loan agreement was signed. But she was the power of attorney when it was she discovered that the loan agreement exists. And she pursued questioning about its existence, asked for the documentation, and that was not provided. So if a duty
But before she discovered it, I mean, your position is that Jenea had an obligation. So let's just say, it sounds like your position is that upon receiving the power of attorney, then Jenea had an obligation to inform Margaret that she had this loan agreement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you have any authority for that?
Only that the Minnesota Statute 524.21 and the following authorities for an attorney in fact gives them the has them step into the shoes of the principal in this case. If Donald LaDuc had the ability to get that information and there was a duty to disclose to him, which I think there would be because he's
well, he knew about it. I mean, well, it would the position of I guess. He was a party to the contract. Why would there be anybody have a duty to inform Donald?
Right. That goes to the point, too, that when questioned about this agreement about a year later, he had no recollection of signing it. He had no recollection that it had been a gift. That's what the trial court record states. I am now out of time. May I finish Your Honor's question?
Oh, yes. Please do answer my question, and then you may sum up.
If there was any duty to provide information about this contract, or its formation to Donald LaDuc, Margaret Nolde, as the attorney, in fact, stepped into his shoes, and that duty would be owed to her. Not at the time it was formed, but when she started asking questions about it, to not provide that information, that was where we have the fraudulent concealment.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to go to Judge Smith's question regarding the incongruence of finding that Donald LaDuc did not have capacity to agree to one term, but apparently did have capacity to agree to the rest. No one's disputing that he agreed to a loan of $200,000 and the interest rate and the 30-year term. The notion that incapacity could be so targeted is, I think, unprecedented in case law. I've looked. I haven't found any examples of that ever being true. And that goes to the merits of the findings themselves. It simply does not make sense whether you look at the burden of proof or the standard of evidence that needs to be provided to say that a person did not reasonably understand what they were doing when they agreed to a limit on a duty to repay when they did understand they were lending $200,000 and the interest rate and the term for repayment.
I recall the district court referring to some type of agreement or perhaps a conditional agreement, something like the parties can accept a remedy where the loan agreement is preserved, but the loan forgiveness is not.
I don't believe there was ever actually any agreement. I looked at that finding. I think what the court was referring to was that Margaret and Gary were willing to accept the loan continuing. It was not an agreement that that was something that Janaea and Bruce wanted to, or Bruce wanted to do. And same for undue influence. The notion that one could so dominate a person's will as to one term, a limit on a duty to repay, but that wasn't at all, that wasn't why the alleged influenced agreed to the loan and the terms, does not make sense. Even if this court reaches the merits, we outline at length about why there's just no there. When you're looking at the clear and convincing burden of evidence to prove either that Donald did not understand that he was forgiving at the time of his and Mary's death, or that Mary understood, whose capacity is not at issue in this case, or if you go to the question of whether Donald or Mary were being puppeteered by Janaea or Bruce, this is a case that exemplifies a basic principle and rule that has come through cases again and again, including in an area where reversals are not uncommon. You cannot take suspicion, concern about motive, perhaps opportunity, and inequality of a distribution or a benefit and shake that all together and say undue influence. The law requires more than both as the substantive standard and from the evidence. That is just not this case. We've challenged the findings. Respondents had an opportunity to rally the evidence they could. We replied. There's just nothing there. I bring up the point that district court was concerned about what it found to be that facially unreasonableness of Janaea getting one benefit that the other four grandchildren did not. That is at least in tough tension with what the Minnesota Supreme Court has said. It's like we're not questioning, we don't look at just a disparity in gift or benefit and say that is enough for undue influence. There needs to be something more. And we have good explanation here about why Donald did what he did, why Mary made this choice. They saw a granddaughter who was single, not similarly situated with the other four kids who had a particularly close relationship with them. This record is silent as to the other four grandchildren and any relationship that they had with Donald and Mary other than that it existed. The record is undisputed about the close relationship between Janaea and her grandparents, the travel, the regular travel to visit them, and the fact that Donald liked helping people. He lent money to Gary. This transaction makes a great deal of sense, and the notion to say it's facially unreasonable is wrong as a matter of clear error and as a matter of law. One fundamental legal error that the district court had is it got its undue influence law flipped. It said because there was a confidential relationship between Donald and Mary and Janaea and Bruce, that makes it easier to prove undue influence. The law flips that inference when we have a blood relationship, which goes all the way back to Marston's estate. Judge Johnson walked through that in a non-presidential opinion, Engman, several years ago, block quoted in our briefing. And I think maybe one of the best authorities on the capacity side is Rhett Siegel. We cite it in the 2019 section regarding why the incapacity findings are clearly erroneous. Rhett Siegel was a case where there were affiants who stated that the testator was of sound mind. They were the people who were there. And there was other stuff around the perimeter, raw meat left out for a week by the testator, not being sure if he was home when he actually was home. But what we look about is what was true in the room, what we know was true. And we have the lawyer and the two swearing witnesses. We know what was true on that day in 2019. If I could make one final point, Your Honor, on a basic rule of incapacity law is that mere mental weakness is not enough. I think it's notable that the district court never actually pulls the trigger in saying Donald lacks capacity or applies the capacity standard. What we see are a cluster of findings about him in decline, being in decline starting in 2016, being true in 2019. The district court never actually says incapacitated. And I don't think that was an accident. I think it's because this case can go no further than mere mental weakness, which is not enough for incapacity. Unless the court has any more questions, which I would be very happy to respond to, I can sit.
It appears there are none.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to all counsel for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its written opinion within 90 days.